Chapter 28. Aside from J. Edgar Hoover, there is one man who shared the risk that Dorothy Kilgallen's search for the truth about who killed JFK could trigger a grand jury investigation. New Orleans Mafia Don, Carlos Marcello. While many underworld figures had good reason to be afraid of what Kilgallen might uncover, Marcello had the most to lose, both his fortune and his freedom. While those benefiting from Kilgallen's death abounded, the one who must have had the broadest smile on his face when she perished was Marcello. To add Marcello's name as a main suspect in Kilgallen's murder, one must first focus on the actions of Joseph P. Kennedy and Robert F. Kennedy instead of JFK, as posited in this author's book, The Poison Patriarch. Doing so raises the question, why wasn't Bobby killed in 1963 instead of JFK? Well before the 1960 presidential election, RFK, a member of the McClellan Committee investigating organized crime, focused on several mafiosos as targets for deportation or imprisonment. During the hearings, Bobby's anger roared when he confronted many of America's top crime bosses. They included Sam Giancana, Carlos Marcello, Santo Traficante, and Melvin Belli's client and close friend, Mickey Cohen. Cohen's FBI file, obtained through the Freedom of Information Act, featured the words, "Cohen had killed in the past and should be considered armed and dangerous." Each of these dangerous men refused to testify by invoking the Fifth Amendment. New York crime boss Frank Costello, a Kilgallen acquaintance as noted, also appeared at the hearings and used the Fifth Amendment as a shield. RFK particularly insulted Sam Giancana. At one point during the hearings, after the mobster erupted into nervous laughter at one of Bobby's questions, RFK said, "I thought only little girls giggled, Mr. Giancana." Carlos Marcello was also embarrassed during Bobby's intense questioning. It was clear that Bobby hated the underworld figures with a passion. In his book, The Enemy Within, RFK wrote, "They have the look of Al Capone's men. They are sleek, often bilious and fat, or lean and cold and hard. They have the smooth faces and cruel eyes of gangsters. They wear the same rich clothes, the diamond ring, the jeweled watch, the strong, sickly, sweet-smelling perfume." RFK's poisonous words came tumbling out, despite it being known that his father, Joe Sr., had cultivated strong friendships with certain mafia figures during his business dealings with them. It should also be remembered that Papa Joe Sr. had aspirations to become U.S. president himself, until he fell from grace by patronizing Adolf Hitler and the Nazis during the patriarch's stint as ambassador to Great Britain from 1938 to 1940. Since Joe Sr.'s reputation had been tarnished, he realized he couldn't become president. To show the world he was still a political force, Joe Sr. decided he would gain the power he coveted by throwing his millions and his power behind his four sons. First up would have been Joe Jr., but he was killed during World War II. That meant Joe Sr. promoted John as a presidential candidate, with Joe Sr.'s grandiose plan, one where RFK and then Edward Ted Kennedy would follow, providing a true Kennedy dynasty in the White House. Neither Bobby nor Ted ever became president, the former due to his assassination, and Ted, at least in part, due to his falsification of the events surrounding the culpability in the drowning of Mary Jo Kopechne at the Chappaquiddick, for which he was at least guilty of involuntary manslaughter. Joe Sr.'s quest for power had no boundaries. Win at any cost was the quest. And to that end, the Poison Patriarch entered into a deal with the devil, triggering potential repercussions he appeared to realize, but somehow decided were worth the risk. Thus, when JFK was battling Vice President Richard Nixon for the presidency, credible sources confirm the elder Kennedy became aware of an important fact. His son would lose the election unless he won West Virginia and Illinois. Without these states' electoral votes in JFK's column, the race was doomed. Not too much speculation is required to point out that Kilgallen, who kept up with the political scene, realized the election would be won or lost in these states. To put his son over the top, to gain the help he required, Joe Sr. knew where to look. Chicago-based mobster Giancana and his underworld friends like Marcello, who had connections to the unions and politicians. Most importantly, millions in cash distributed by underworld emissaries could produce votes. Desperate, Joe Sr. recruited family friend Frank Sinatra, Kilgallen's foe. He became the intermediary to solicit the mobster's assistance with money and power in West Virginia, and especially in Chicago, where the corrupt mayor Richard J. Daley ruled. Tina, Sinatra's daughter, confirmed this account. Interviewed on 60 Minutes to promote her book, My Father's Daughter, Tina stated, "My father got Chicago mob boss Sam Giancana to help John F. Kennedy win the presidency by asking my father to talk to the mafia about securing the labor union vote in the crucial West Virginia primary in 1960. An editorial on the Sinatra family website was written by daughter Nancy. She posted the quote, "Please keep in mind when reading or hearing stories about JFK, F.S., Frank Sinatra, and Sam Giancana, that it was Joseph Kennedy Sr. who approached Frank for help in contacting Sam Giancana, because he knew Frank, like all others on the circuit, performed in nightclubs owned by mob bosses." Nancy Sinatra also told author Seymour Hersh, "Over lunch, Joe Sr. said, 'I think that you can help me in West Virginia and Illinois with our friends. You understand, Frank, I can't go see them. They're my friends too, but I can't approach them. But you can.' I know that gave Dad pause, but it still wasn't anything he felt he shouldn't do. So, off to Sam Giancana he went." The Chicago mobster's violent reputation apparently did not concern Joe Sr. Popular singer Paul Anka, Diana, Put Your Head on My Shoulder, Puppy Love, who crossed paths with Giancana, wrote in his book My Way, "Everybody knew the mafia boss from Chicago was someone not to be messed with. He had a violent M.O. The bottom line is, Sam was a murderer." Always the wheeler-dealer, Joe Sr., who knew that at one point the mafia don shared girlfriend Judith Campbell with JFK, a repulsive indication of Kennedy's philandering ways, this time to the extreme, promised something in return. If JFK became president, the new administration would tread lightly on any mafia investigations. Due to the mobster's influence, much of it illegal, the Kennedy patriarch strategy worked. JFK won both West Virginia and Illinois and was elected president. He beat Vice President Richard Nixon by the slimmest of margins, 112,827 votes out of 68 million plus, 0.16%, 303 electoral votes to 219. Later, Evelyn Lincoln, JFK's secretary, admitted, "They, the Kennedys, stole the election." Mobster Mickey Cohen agreed, telling friends, "The presidency was really stolen in Chicago." Sam Giancana boasted to Judith Campbell, "Listen, honey, if it wasn't for me, your boyfriend wouldn't even be in the White House." Secure that their Justice Department and congressional troubles were over with JFK in the White House, Giancana, Marcello, Cohen, Trafficante, and Frank Costello, among others, expected Joe Sr. to keep his word. They should have known better, since Joe Sr.'s morals, his ethics, had been severely lacking for decades on end. While researching material for The Poison Patriarch, this author discovered that Kennedy family confidant John Siegenthaler had witnessed a defining moment in American history. Siegenthaler, later to become the founding editorial director of USA Today, as well as a stout defender of First Amendment rights, told this author he was present when Joe Sr. ordered JFK to appoint Bobby Attorney General. Siegenthaler, who along with Ed Guthman, Nicholas Katzenbach, John Doerr, and Brian Whizzer White were known as RFK's Band of Brothers, said, "The president first floated the balloon about Bobby becoming the Attorney General during a Florida golf match with Bill Lawrence of the New York Times," Siegenthaler recalled. "Bobby told me, 'That's Dad,'" meaning Joe Sr. was insisting on the appointment and behind the hint to Lawrence. One steamy evening, Siegenthaler, Bobby's administrative assistant at the time, told this author he ate dinner with RFK and Ethel at their Hickory Hill home. Siegenthaler said, "They talked about how RFK could teach, write, and travel, and what a great career he had in front of him. Bobby wasn't going to take the job, and he said, 'This will kill Dad,' a reference to disappointing Joe Sr. But the next morning, during breakfast of bacon and eggs with JFK at his Georgetown flat, the president, in my presence, responded to Bobby's initiating words. 'Now, about my situation,' by telling his younger brother, 'there is no one around I really know. I need someone who will be interested in my interests, and I need you.'" During the 7 to 10 minute highly intense monologue, Siegenthaler recalled, "JFK made his case, brief and concise, by saying that Bobby was best qualified to handle organized crime and so forth. JFK then poured them both some coffee, before Bobby said, 'Well, I have some points to make.' But Jack had made up his mind, and he said, 'Let's just grab our balls and go.'" The arrogant Kennedy patriarch insisted JFK appoint Bobby Attorney General, even though Joe Sr. knew, based on RFK's obsessive pursuit of mafia figures, including Marcello, during the McClellan racketeering hearings, that Bobby would, in all likelihood, relentlessly pursue the mobsters. In the eyes of the angry underworld figures, Joe Sr. was double-crossing them. In the book Mob Lawyer, Frank Regano, attorney for Marcello, Traficante, and James Hoffa, quoted Giancana, described by author Evan Thomas as one who had hung people on meat hooks, as saying, "That rat bastard son of a bitch, we broke our balls for him, JFK, and gave him the election, and he gets his brother Bobby to hound us to death." Sam's daughter, Antoinette Giancana, wrote in Mafia Princess, "When Sam learned that Robert F. Kennedy had been appointed Attorney General, he felt it was a rabbit punch in the dark." Prior to JFK's assassination, Joe Sr. had been warned by a crime family emissary that RFK needed to back off his pursuit of underworld figures based on Joe Sr.'s promise. The Kennedy patriarch agreed to speak to Bobby, but instead had JFK do so, especially after an FBI wiretap indicated Giancana's displeasure with RFK's campaign to destroy the mafia. Despite JFK's plea, Bobby refused to back off. A few days later, Joe Sr. suffered a stroke, from which he never fully recovered. It took less than 4 months for Bobby to launch a crusade to prosecute the mobsters, with his first assault coming on April 4, 1961, when, according to the HSCA report, RFK had overseen and orchestrated the abduction of Marcello in New Orleans. When the irreverent Don walked into the Immigration and Naturalization Service to report as an alien, agents arrested and handcuffed him, whisked him off to a waiting plane, and dumped him unceremoniously in Guatemala City. The next day, a smiling RFK took credit for the deportation, while Marcello and his powerful allies vowed revenge, dubbing the incident nothing less than a kidnapping. After being shunted off to Guatemala, Marcello, who was proud of a sign hung on the inside of a doorframe leading out of his office that read, "Three can keep a secret if two are dead," wandered through the jungle, nearly dying, before surreptitiously re-entering the United States. One may imagine the rage Marcello exhibited, with revenge a certainty. An Associated Press story, describing Marcello as being handcuffed and silent while herded by three Border Patrol agents to a waiting plane, quoted Marcello's attorney, Jack Wasserman, as calling the government's reactions barbarous and completely illegal, with the action amounting to kidnapping. The New York Times quoted the ACLU as agreeing to the illegal kidnapping allegation. Acclaimed author Nick Pileggi, Wise Guy, Life in a Mafia Family, the basis for the movie Goodfellas, and Casino, Love and Honor in Las Vegas, based on his research, knew the inside story about Marcello. He told this author, "Marcello was Sicilian, but born in Tunisia, and grew up with both Sicilian and Arabic vendetta tendencies. He was not a turn-the-other-cheek kind of guy. Fury and revenge were his credo." RFK's relentless pursuit of Marcello, who had infuriated the Attorney General by re-entering the United States after being deported, continued. The Justice Department renewed deportation charges against the New Orleans Don, and also charged him with conspiracy to defraud the government in New Orleans federal court. With the fall of 1963 fast approaching, Marcello had exhausted every deportation appeal while also facing the conspiracy charges trial. Action was necessary, since the prospect of prison or being forced out of the U.S. loomed ahead. Either way, Marcello's empire would be toppled. Ultimately, the decision to kill John Kennedy instead of Bobby was a no-brainer. Marcello knew that if he had RFK killed, JFK would use all of the government's resources to come after him. However, if JFK was assassinated, then RFK would be rendered powerless. In the House Select Committee on Assassinations report, Marcello is quoted as telling an informant, "The president was the dog. The Attorney General Kennedy was its tail. If you cut off the tail, the dog will keep biting. But if you chop off the head, the dog will die, tail and all." After JFK was assassinated, Nancy Regano, wife of Frank Regano, attorney for Carlos Marcello, Santo Trafficante, and James Hoffa, told this author she watched Frank and Marcello's close friend Trafficante laugh, joke, and raise glasses of champagne high in the air. Each was toasting JFK's assassination at the International Inn, a five-star hotel in Tampa, Florida. Meanwhile, shortly after noon Central Standard Time on November 22nd, Marcello, during a break in the testimony of his racketeering trial in New Orleans that RFK had been discussing at his home when he learned JFK was shot, was tapped on the shoulder by David Ferry, one of his underlings. He informed Marcello, "Our troubles are over. JFK is dead." The jury retired to reach a verdict, and Marcello was acquitted in an hour. A short time after JFK's senseless death, a victim of his father and brother's poisonous misdeeds and not his own, RFK, as Marcello had predicted, did become powerless. He disbanded the Justice Department's Organized Crime Division, specifically intended to put mobsters like Marcello out of business. No wonder the mobsters had rejoiced. Besides Bobby's statement, when Hoover called him minutes after JFK was shot, "I thought it would be me," during summer 1967, RFK, in a rare moment of disclosure, told advisor and speechwriter Richard Goodwin, husband of noted historian Doris Kearns Goodwin, that he believed his brother was killed by the guy from New Orleans, meaning Marcello. Due to RFK's realization that it had been his actions toward the mafia causing his brother Jack's death, Bobby experienced tremendous guilt, leading to his readings of the Greek classics and the Bible, his mention of the mafia and Marcello to colleagues, and his inability to function after the assassination. RFK knew in his heart that JFK should have never died or been assassinated, that the wrong man had paid the ultimate penalty. When told by Edward Kennedy that JFK had been murdered, Joe Sr. swept a copy of the New York Times off his bed as he yelped in agony. His worst fears had been realized, that JFK had been killed by the mafia based on revenge for Bobby's actions. Robert Kennedy Jr. confirmed RFK's suspicions during a January 2013 interview on PBS. RFK Jr. said his father told him he believed the Warren Commission report was a shoddy piece of craftsmanship. RFK Jr. also stated, "Dad spent a year trying to come to grips with my uncle's death, reading the work of Greek philosophers, Catholic scholars, Henry David Thoreau, poets, and others, trying to figure out the existential implications of why a just God would allow injustice to happen of the magnitude he was seeing." RFK's use of the word injustice points to his admission that his older brother was certainly denied justice, a confession of sorts of his culpability in JFK's death. RFK Jr., who alleged in 2018 that he believed Sirhan Sirhan did not kill his father, said the evidence was very, very convincing that it was not a lone gunman who shot JFK. When asked on PBS if he believed that RFK, who, during a Chicago speech, had branded Marcello a malignant threat to society, felt some sense of guilt because he thought there might have been a link between his very aggressive efforts against organized crime, RFK Jr. said his father had investigators do research into the assassination and found that phone records of Oswald and nightclub owner Jack Ruby were like an inventory of mafia leaders the government had been investigating. Common sense logic dictates this inventory must have included Carlos Marcello, whom RFK had bird-dogged from the outset of his being named Attorney General. Note, RFK Jr.'s account echoes that from JFK presidential candidate Ken O'Donnell during a conversation with RFK. O'Donnell said, "I mentioned the syndicate, the mob, as a possibility. I'm certain RFK thought the mob had been involved. He suspected Carlos Marcello, the New Orleans capo to whom Jack Ruby had ties." Marcello's plan had worked, but now Ruby was a loose end who needed to be silenced. Threatening him seemed the best alternative, and so mafioso Joe Campisi, one of Ruby's three closest friends, made a house call to the jail where Ruby was in custody. Somehow the fact that Marcello's Dallas henchman became Ruby's first visitor escaped media attention, because it would appear like lapdogs, they had followed without question Hoover's Oswald Alone proclamations, thus focusing on him while neglecting to connect Marcello with Ruby through Campisi. To assure Ruby he would be taken care of, Campisi informed Ruby that help was on the way through an attorney who was mob-controlled. Melvin Belli was that attorney, one who was mob-approved due to his representation of Cohen. Former Belli legal associate, John O'Connor, told this author, "Mel was tight with Mickey Cohen and talked about him all the time. He certainly was one with connections to the underworld, and my understanding was that he was approved as okay by the mob." Seymour Ellison, the former partner who accompanied Belli to Las Vegas on several occasions, told this author, "Mel loved the mob, and they loved him." Another Belli associate, who wished to remain anonymous, said, "Mel was intoxicated with the mafia." He told this author, "He loved the power, the money, the irreverence they had for authority, just like he did." Ellison also knew Belli's bookkeeper had ties to the Bonanno crime family. Belli played his part well in the plan to negate Ruby's credibility by employing the ludicrous psychomotor epilepsy insanity defense at trial. By even the mention of those words, Ruby appeared crazy in the eyes of nearly anyone who later investigated the assassinations. Belli then prevented Ruby from testifying, despite his client's requests to do so. Ruby was no longer a loose end of concern to Marcello. Frank Regano, Marcello's attorney, Regano also represented James Hoffa and Santo Trafficante, and Belli were very close friends, to the extent of Belli representing Regano when he sued Time magazine for libel in 1966, 3 years after JFK's assassination. Under the banner Top Cosa Nostra Hoodlums, Time posted a photograph, one that included Trafficante, Marcello, Joseph Colombo of the Colombo crime family, co-bosses of the Genovese family, and Marcello's New Orleans attorney, Jack Wasserman. When Regano told Trafficante about hiring Belli to sue Time for labeling Regano a mobster, Trafficante said to Regano, "Listen, whatever you do, don't ask him about Jack Ruby. It's none of your business." Nancy Regano said her husband avoided any mention of Belli after that time, intimating to her that Belli was more involved in the JFK assassination conspiracy than anyone realized. Regardless, from his perch in New Orleans, Marcello had to be celebrating. JFK had been eliminated, rendering Bobby powerless. And since the mob-friendly LBJ occupied the White House, Marcello was safe from deportation. That was the good news. But the bad news was the continual snooping into the JFK and Oswald assassinations by one reporter, Dorothy Kilgallen. How to stop the feisty reporter had to be a main concern. On a daily basis, Marcello considered his alternatives, searching for the right answer to contain his nemesis. Meanwhile, Kilgallen, familiar with mob hit operations designed to silence those with loose tongues, had reviewed her JFK assassination investigation file notes, especially those dealing with the most significant bits of testimony she had learned at Ruby's trial. Of paramount importance is her knowledge that it was no coincidence Ruby had been in the Dallas Morning News offices with a direct eye line to Dealey Plaza at almost the exact time JFK was shot, meaning that he, in all likelihood, had advanced notice of the assassination. It was difficult to reconcile Ruby performing on a twist board less than 24 hours after the president's assassination with the bereaved figure of a man who says he walked around in a state of emotional shock, Kilgallen column. Based on his stating he would be there, Ruby had been stalking Oswald when JFK's alleged assassin was transferred from the Dallas Police Department jail. Ruby had entered the jail basement acting like as a reporter. These and other startling factors confirmed Kilgallen's belief that Hoover's Oswald alone proclamation was pure bunk, since she must have realized Oswald had been hit by Ruby, connected to Marcello through Joe Campisi and Dallas crime boss Joseph Civello, with Campisi being the first jail visitor for Ruby. Since the New Orleans-based Marcello was involved, JFK had been hit in retaliation for Bobby Kennedy's crusade to eliminate organized crime figures, specifically Marcello. The hitman Ruby's mental state had been muddied when Belli employed the insanity defense at Ruby's trial, and most importantly, had never let Ruby testify. With these facts in mind, just imagine if Kilgallen, certainly in danger for what she had learned, had been aware that it appeared Belli had known of JFK's assassination in advance, as evidenced by Belli having said to his friend, J. Kelly Ferris, as noted, "Well, since Oswald's dead, I'll have to defend Ruby," after Belli first learned of Oswald's death from a San Francisco waiter. Kilgallen also did not know that Belli, during the Ruby trial, had told his close friend and chauffeur Milton Hunt, as noted, "The Ruby case is fixed. I'm just going through the motions. It's simply being staged for the sake of publicity. There's an inside thing, and no way to win. It's a whitewash," making it appear Belli intentionally threw the Ruby case like a boxer who takes a dive for personal gain. These unsettling facts certainly would have solidified Kilgallen's suspicions of a mob hit start to finish, based on her knowledge of Belli's mafia connections, Cohen, and the savvy reporters being unable to comprehend, like so many others, including the Ruby prosecutors and the judge, why Belli never pleaded for Ruby's life to be spared by the jury in the event of a guilty verdict during Belli's final argument. Apparently, by design, the corrupted Belli had sealed Ruby's fate, made him look crazy, denied him the right to testify, and then virtually guaranteed a death sentence if he was convicted. Even without the Ferris and Hunt statements by Belli, the above scenario caused Kilgallen to believe that JFK's death was senseless, simply part of a mob operation. She knew the president was collateral damage to those who hated Bobby, but couldn't hit the attorney general for fear the government would come calling with all of its guns blazing. JFK paid the price. Bobby was no longer a threat to his enemies. Kilgallen's trial interviews of Ruby, discarded by nearly every so-called assassinations expert, are most important in a historical sense, especially since whatever he told her caused the first of two planned trips to Marcello's home turf, New Orleans. Joe Tannehill stated, in his videotaped interview, that Jack wasn't uttering nonsense because this interview with her was very significant in his classless life, you know. And I think he enjoyed it very much and cooperated with Kilgallen in every way that he could and told her the truth as he understood it. And it was just a very agreeable conversation between them. And I just can't understand people doubting the sincerity of that interview. Because to me, and I watched them, it was a very sincere discussion going back and forth. Asked why Ruby had decided to speak to Kilgallen, Tannehill stated, "I don't think there was any doubt about it. Jack was highly impressed with Dorothy Kilgallen, and he figured she was a very classy person. She had good programs, What's My Line, and she was a highly intelligent person. And I think of all the writers that were down there during the Ruby trial, about 400 from all over the world, she probably was the one that, to him, was the most significant because he was in the entertainment business. He had a strip joint, and he looked upon her as someone who could be able to help him. And he was trying to get help from everybody he could that had any significant standing in the community or anywhere else. He was a name dropper, you know." Interview excerpt available at thedorothykilgallenstory.org. Author Lee Israel echoed Tannehill's comments regarding the validity of the Jack Ruby interviews. In a column that she wrote about Kilgallen after she died, which appeared in a Staten Island Sunday newspaper under the banner, "Mystery Still Lingers Over Kilgallen Probe of JFK's Murder," Israel wrote, "Most salient was Kilgallen's failure to print anything about what had transpired between she and Ruby. Had the exchange been wholly crazed or nugatory, Dorothy would have had no motive not to publish. That she withheld strongly suggests that she was either saving the information for her book, that he furnished her with a lead she was actively pursuing, or that he exacted a promise of confidentiality from her. Each possibility puts her in the thick of things." Without question, Marcello saw Kilgallen, who was definitely in the thick of things, in the image of his archenemy, Bobby Kennedy. Like RFK, Kilgallen's crusade was personal and not just business. JFK was her friend, the president who had been so kind to young Kerry. When Marcello learned Kilgallen had been in New Orleans, he must have roared with anger. Of all the cities she could have visited to continue her investigation, she had picked his home base. Had Ruby steered her to his doorstep? Marcello had to wonder. While Kilgallen was in New Orleans, was she under surveillance by Marcello and his mafia thugs? There is no way to know for certain. But it made sense that Marcello, a cold-blooded killer, who, when an enemy threatened, caused the man to be strangled and his body thrown in a tub of caustic acid. The remains were then dumped into a swamp where alligators would take care of the rest. Had her movements monitored. Perhaps she learned of the surveillance, and that was why she phoned Mark Sinclair and told him to leave the city immediately and never tell anyone he was even there. Something had spooked her, and she was worried for her close friend's safety. No wonder. Kilgallen was investigating a man who had an immense amount of money at stake, if he was nailed for masterminding the JFK assassination. According to The Plot to Kill the President by G. Robert Blakey and Richard N. Billings, by 1963, the mobster was grossing many millions annually, $500 million from illegal gambling, $100 million from illegal activities in over 1,500 syndicate-connected bars, $8 million from professional burglaries and holdups, $6 million from prostitution, and $400 million from diverse investments. When he wanted to relax, Marcello enjoyed his $22 million, 6,500-acre estate, Churchill Farms, near New Orleans. Kilgallen's belief that Marcello had orchestrated the JFK and Oswald assassinations mirrored those of the HSCA report in the late 1970s, which stated, "Carlos Marcello had the motive, means, and opportunity to have President John F. Kennedy assassinated," though we were unable to establish direct evidence of Marcello's complicity. If the committee had scoured the salient facts surrounding Kilgallen's death in tandem with the above statement, they arguably could have targeted Marcello with much more specificity. One man who believed Marcello was somehow involved in Kilgallen's death was a former New Orleans resident who contacted this author in 2017, requesting his identity be kept secret for fear of repercussion. He said he met the 5'2" Marcello, known as the Little Man, one year when I went to every New Orleans Saints game with a man named Alan Alario, and we went to Sal Saya's suite to watch the game. Carlos was there a few times. Sam Saya, Sal's brother, was linked to Carlos and Lee Harvey Oswald, and in fact, was probably a connection between the two. The former resident described Marcello. "Well, you really didn't want to be speaking to him directly, but from listening to him, he sounded a bit gruff. One of the couriers that worked for him described him as the big grub, an apparent reference to the mafia's threatening family members when they needed to stop an associate from talking too much, and I guess that summed up his facial features being somewhat resembling a big grub. He wasn't a big man, probably more average in height and stature. Again, you didn't want his attention. Once, while at Chapatulas Restaurant in Avondale, bar restaurant I hung out in, Mr. Marcello came in with a number of his associates, and they seated themselves at the other side of the horseshoe-shaped bar. After they ordered their drinks, I asked the bartender, a good friend of mine, to bring him a drink on me. After she served him, he looked over at me and whispered something to one of his associates. The associate came over and introduced himself to me as the Turk and had the bartender bring me two drinks. He said, 'Mr. Marcello thanks you for your hospitality, but he doesn't want to be indebted to anybody.' The Turk and I chatted for probably about 10 to 15 minutes. In 1979, the former New Orleans resident encountered an associate of Marcello who told him that the Mafia Don was so infuriated when Bobby Kennedy had him kidnapped and dumped in Guatemala that he went for revenge. Dumped in the jungle was the term he used. When Marcello returned to the U.S., this author's source said the mafioso stayed at a fishing camp in Grand Isle, Louisiana, with Provino Mosca as his personal chef. In 1946, Mosca, an Italian immigrant, had opened a restaurant with the same name in a building owned by Marcello, who was a regular customer of the restaurant. It remains a fixture today as a New Orleans institution. Concerning a recent scenario as to why and how Carlos Marcello decided to rid the world of JFK in order to make RFK powerless, respected author Matthew Randazzo provided a credible account from a New Orleans crime figure who was a close friend of Marcello. According to Kent Frenchy Brouillette, a sinister character in the New Orleans underworld, who wise guys called the Keith Richards of the American Mafia, and JFK investigator Jim Garrison denounced as one of the most notorious vice operators in the history of New Orleans, Brouillette saw and met with Lee Harvey Oswald in New Orleans on several occasions, and specifically in Marcello's office shortly before the assassination. This supports the logical inference that Kilgallen had discovered the same connection between these two men and Jack Ruby during her trip to New Orleans shortly before she died, a conclusion Marcello could not allow Kilgallen to reveal in her book. Various quotes from Brouillette in Randazzo's highly acclaimed book, Mr. New Orleans, The Life of a Big Easy Underworld Legend, bear consideration regarding connections with Kilgallen's investigation. They include, "I come from the same New Orleans traditions as the pirates, Jean and Pierre Lafitte. Though I wouldn't put myself in the same category as the Lafittes, my associates included three men who would go toe-to-toe with them any day. New York's Frank Costello, New Orleans' own Carlos Marcello, and Silvestro Silver Dollar Sam Carollo." The small, aging, big-nosed gentleman who extended his hand to me was the meekest and most unobtrusive person I had yet met in the big-talking, cocky New Orleans. He looked like a professor or an IRS agent in a narrow, tailored suit. I was eye-to-eye with Frank Costello. It was in the spring of 1963 that a plan to kill JFK supposedly took shape. The architects included Marcello and Trafficante. My first Oswald sighting came in Carlos's office at the Pelican Tomato Company, a small vegetable wholesaling company run by his mafia confidant, Joe Baby Matassa. I was unprepared for the shock I felt when I found Carlos sitting there with Oswald. After that meeting at the Pelican Tomato Company, it seemed like I couldn't go anywhere without running into goddamn Lee Harvey Oswald. As far as Oswald, he was just a patsy in the assassination. They had assurance they would be able to get rid of him real quick, since Dallas was Carlos's town. Jack Ruby was the perfect solution, a Chicago mob guy with ties to Carlos who was a police station hangaround. They pay him off, lean on him a bit, and he whacks Oswald. That ties everything up in a bow. In effect, Brouillette described the New Orleans underworld atmosphere Kilgallen visited shortly before she died, one where Marcello, Ruby, and Oswald were connected prior to JFK's assassination. Regarding Brouillette's veracity, Randazzo was a believer, telling this author, "There were multiple people I interviewed who saw Frenchie with Oswald. He would say, 'Here's my buddy Lee.' Frenchie saying he saw Oswald and Marcello together is real. And I don't believe Frenchie ever deliberately lied to me about anything. He wouldn't concoct things." To probe further the worthiness of Brouillette's account, as passed on to author Randazzo, this author interviewed former New Orleans federal prosecutor and United States congressman Bob Livingston. He became aware of the low-life gangster when he convicted him of violation of the Mann Act, interstate transportation of prostitutes, circa 1972. Livingston was impressed with the women who testified at the trial, but could not provide additional information about Brouillette. To gain more information about Brouillette, this author secured his 1,700-page FBI file. Perusing it provided confirmation of Frenchie's various arrests, but no solid connection to Marcello or Oswald. Regarding any information he garnered about Kilgallen, Randazzo said, "I cannot divulge the sources, but older New Orleans mobsters told me there is a lot more to the JFK assassination than Ruby and Oswald. There is Mary Sherman and Dorothy Kilgallen." Note, Mary Sherman was a New Orleans-based medical researcher with connections to the JFK assassination, who was murdered on the day the Warren Commission visited New Orleans to interview witnesses. Randazzo's staunch belief that Frenchie was a credible witness, that he had seen Oswald, born in New Orleans, with Marcello, provides another possible piece of the puzzle, the hornet's nest of mob infiltration of New Orleans orchestrated by the multimillionaire kingpin Marcello when Kilgallen visited there a few weeks before her death. The remaining question, of course, is who Kilgallen had in mind when she told What's My Line makeup man Carmen Gabia, in answer to his question, "Is it Kennedy?" prior to the trip she took to Louisiana. Yes, and it's very cloak and daggerish. I'm going to meet a source whom I do not know, but will recognize, who is going to give me information about the case.